You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today. At LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
So an actor is saying his lines, yeah. And then out of nowhere, he just starts singing.
5, 6, 7, 8.
My ears are alive with the sound of
Jimmy. Don't cry for me.
Welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Welcome to Guys Who Like Musicals.
Davey Nathan
is here.
Thank you. You officially win for the coolest backdrop background of any person that we've talked to.
Oh, for sure.
Thanks, y'all.
What is in the background there? Those are a bunch of toys that I want to play with.
A bunch of like old synthesizers. It's like most expensive wallpaper ever.
Are you in your studio?
Yes.
Is this a studio in your home or is this like...
Yeah, I'm in my house, which I never leave, even prior to COVID. and I work out of here in California. And it's like the dream home studio setup for me.
Well, this week we are particularly talking about Jingle Jangle, the new Christmas spectacular that's coming out on Netflix. And when we drop this, we're recording it a little before, but it is literally today. It's coming out today. And so we're here to talk to Davey about it. We're so thrilled that you're here. We're going to rattle off a couple of your credits, just a few to make you feel wildly uncomfortable. Right. Davey is a singer. Davey is a songwriter, producer, pianist, and music director whose work was considered for a Grammy in 2017. As a producer and songwriter, he's worked with, list them, Rodney Jerkins, Tony Braxton, Philip Lawrence, Bruno Mars, Mary J. Blige, Jennifer Hudson, Robin Thicke, Tamar Braxton, Kenny Babyface Edmonds, Queen Latifah, and a million others. Dan, how'd I do? As a pianist,
pretty good. Except let's just for the people in Wisconsin, Philip Lawrence is Bruno Mars. So just let's just make that very
yeah yeah slash
partner
yeah.
There, yeah. As a pianist and music director, he's toured the world with Christina Aguilera, Tony Braxton, Patti LaBelle, also Babyface, Colby Calais, among so many others, TLC, Brian McKnight. This is crazy. We are very uncool.
What's it like to be you?
What's it like to be cool?
Man, that's a tough one. I can't believe I did all that stuff. That's crazy. But I did. It just happened, and it was 10 years of touring with all those people, and I stopped doing that about 6 years ago. So I can give you my whole story.
Yeah, let's hear it.
We want all of it.
Ride. I'm originally from Israel, and
amazing.
I moved to the States when I was 17, and I went to high school for 1 year, and then I went to Berkeley.
Nice
in Boston. Berklee College of Music. And there I started like really working in the, you know, in the clubs around town. And I was in a wedding band for 6 years. And then I got my first tour was with Brian McKnight. I was 24 years old. And I toured with him for a year and a half. And then that started my touring career. I toured for 10 years with all those people.
Amazing.
My second gig was with Patti LaBelle. And that was like my real school. Like,
yeah,
you know,
she took you to school literally.
Yeah, literally. There's no computer on stage. it's in real time. She is the real deal. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think after a few months, so when I started, I was the third keyboard player. There was a pianist, an organist, and I was playing keyboards. And I don't think she even noticed that I was there till I didn't even know I was on stage. There's so many people on stage, you know. And slowly I graduated to second keyboard chair. And then after a few months, I was musical director. I was playing piano. And wow. The way that it happened was I got a call 2 days before a show. And it was like, we need you to be musical director in 2 days. And oh, run the show, you know, run the band and all the background singers and just her and run it. Run the ship. And I did it. And I did it for about 6 months. And it was an amazing experience. You know, she has 50 albums. So
right. Yeah.
She would come to soundcheck. And at the end of soundcheck, she'd be like, oh, I want to do this song tonight. And so it would be my job to go to the dressing room. I think iTunes would just started. And I would download the song and write charts for everybody. And here, there we go. See you on stage.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. See, that was my question. I was going to say, did she just like, you know, in the middle of it, just start shouting out songs that like, you know, may, you know, the band may or may not know. Right.
Right. And she is so real that if in the middle of the show, if she wants to go on a rant, or like cuss the band out or something like, like, all right, break it down. Let me talk to these people. And she'll just go off.
Oh my God.
Awesome.
That's so sick.
I have a lot of Patti LaBelle stories.
No, but I just want to just highlight something there. Now, it's not something that, you know, as a non-musician myself, just a singer, just a humble singer, I'm pretty impressed by the fact that you can just like hear these charts and write out all these charts for all these people and all these instruments. What's your background like as a musician before kind of getting into touring and doing all of that stuff? How did you get into being such a music director whiz?
Right. I started taking lessons when I was 5, and I had a good teacher when I was growing up who taught me harmony and theory when I was like 10. So by the time I got to high school, and I went to an arts high school in Israel, and they taught us all that stuff, and I already knew it, harmony and theory. And then when I got to Berkeley, they taught us that stuff again. So it was just like, I was always playing piano, always went hand in hand with harmony and theory and knowing all that stuff. And also I'll mention ear training. Ear training is so important as a musician. I think listening is like the first instrument that we have. I was, you know, I don't like to show off, but I was born with perfect pitch. But even that is something that I always work on, even to this day. So I remember even being 6, 7, 8 years old, listening to the radio and picking out the notes or the chords, you know, in pop songs or something like that. And then if I couldn't figure something out, I would go to the piano and figure it out. So ear training was always something I did. It goes hand in hand with harmony and theory. So
that's amazing.
That, and then when I was 18, I started working and playing in clubs and playing weddings. And I would have to write charts all the time, and I would have to do it quickly. So I just got good at writing charts. And then fast forward, I'll fast forward to like 10 years ago, I worked on X Factor, the TV show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And on that show, we would have to learn 150 songs a week.
Whoa.
So you have to be really quick at writing charts. Like, so basically, like I listen to a song and I'm writing it as the song is going on. So same with the touring with McKnight or Patti LaBelle or Toni Braxton. I was kind of known around the musicians world as like, I could learn a show really, really quickly. Like in 2 days I could learn a show and then go play it. Cause I would just chart everything out, every little move and all the songs and transitions and also, keyboard patches or whatever. I started playing a lot of keyboards, but then I transitioned to piano as far as my touring career. So that's how knowledge of harmony theory and ear training.
I love that so much. And I, when I was growing up, you know, mom put me in front of a piano and, you know, doing piano lessons or whatever. And I loved, I could figure everything out by ear. And my teacher was like, you know, no, you got to read the notes. And it wasn't until we started studying theory in college where I was like, no, ear training is a skill and it can be developed. And it's not just a party trick when you're like 8 years old, 10, you know, I was like 10 years old and I was like, this is kind of what Imagine sounds like. And my mom was like, you're a genius. And I was like, I was like, oh, well, that's cool. But like never developed it. And then that's one of the things that I tell students and young people all the time. Like if you sit down at the piano, like learning ear training is so incredibly valuable. Mm-hmm. And it also sounds like in a world pre, you know, we have like guitar tabs and, you know, computers and stuff. This is probably a world where this was before all of that. You had to chart out 10,000 right. Patti LaBelle songs and you had no cheat. You had no way to cheat, which like,
that's right. And also ear training, I think is kind of limitless, because even if you're really good, I could, you know, put a, I don't know, like a big band arrangement and can you hear all the instruments and what they're playing? Or I could put on like Stravinsky and can you hear everything? And,
right.
You know, hear all the harmony and what, you know, the relationship between the notes and everything. And that's the real test. I remember when I was 18 at Berkeley, I started transcribing solos, jazz solos. And Herbie Hancock really opened my hearing up. Like it was like a real experience of like before Herbie and after Herbie listening to music.
Right.
When you transcribe jazz solos, it kind of opens up your hearing where you can hear things a lot faster and you just dissect music differently. It's hard to describe the experience, but ear training is
where
it's
so cool. That's so freaking cool. Well, we want to keep talking about all of this, but we brought you on to talk about Jingle Jangle in particular because this is such an exciting new project. And the little bit that we were able to read about it, because it feels like it's been very hush hush, yet it's been in development for 20 years or something. Right. It feels like based on what we were able to sort of read. But we'll talk a little bit about this movie, and then we really want to know how you got involved and also your relationship, because we are guys who like musicals, what your relationship is to musical theater. But Jingle Jangle is going to come out today. It's written and directed by David E. Talbert. The film is set in the town of Cobbleton and follows legendary toy maker. How do we say?
What is it? Geronicus.
Geronicus Jangle.
Yes.
Played by Forest Whitaker, whose fanciful inventions burst with whimsy and wonder. But when his trusted apprentice, Keegan-Michael Key, steals his most prized possession, it's up to his equally bright and inventive granddaughter and a long forgotten invention to heal old wounds. Honestly, this trailer is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
This trailer was a bright spot in 2020.
Yes. I know. They don't make movies like this anymore.
No.
Yeah. And it's Netflix's first live action musical, correct?
Right. Yes.
It's so sick. How did you come to work on the project? How did this come about for you?
Right. This is a really long story. So
great. We got well, that's literally why you're here.
We got time.
We got time.
So okay, so after Patti LaBelle, I started working with Toni Braxton and I did a couple tours with her and then she got a Vegas show. So she said, I want you to move to Vegas. I moved to Vegas, did the show with her. I was in Vegas for 3 years. In that time, I met Philip Lawrence in Vegas. We were working with an artist that lives in Vegas and that artist would bring Phil to help out with songwriting and vocal arrangements and that kind of thing. And Philip was a broke songwriter living in LA, sleeping on couches, that kind of thing. And the way that Phil and I would write songs was that we would just improvise. Like I would just start playing and he would just start singing. And he improvises lyrics and melody. He's one of the only people that I've ever met that can do that. It's really incredible. And I have a jazz background, so I love improvising and it's just, he is like a jazz musician to me. But we were making these like R&B songs and one day we were improvising and it sounded like musical theater.
Mm.
And he looked at me and he said, we're going to write a musical one day.
Oh my gosh.
Philip is a very epic dude, you know?
Yeah.
And then he goes back to LA. He meets Bruno Mars. the rest is their history, right? And right.
And just for people who kind of don't know, as you picture the Hooligans, and if you picture Bruno Mars, Philip is literally right next to him. He's with the glasses.
That's right.
He's right there. So for people, yeah. You know, in our audio podcast world, that might be helpful.
And you know, originally they got together in order to, like, their goal was to write for other people. They didn't think Bruno was the star. So they were a team. And so, but you know, things happened how they did, and Bruno blew up. And I remember in 2009, I went back to LA and I started seeing them perform. And I was like, oh, here's Phil. And they blew up, first album, second album with Treasure and, you know, Locked Out of Heaven. And then it was a couple of months before they did the Super Bowl for the first time. I get a phone call from Phil. It was 8 years later. I had the same number. He had the same number. And he said, all right, you ready to do this musical? and we both started laughing. And I was at his house the next night, and the project was it was a movie for Fox called The Greatest Showman.
Yep.
And
heard of it.
Heard of it. So sorry, what, so this is 2009?
12, 13 maybe.
2013. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Wow. So we started working on Showman. And we met with the director a bunch of times, and we flew to New York. We recorded Hugh Jackman, and we thought we had this thing. And then they just stopped calling. You know, we later found out that they went through about six or seven other teams of songwriters until they ended up with Pask and Paul. And
wow,
yeah, we didn't get that gig. Phil and I were, you know, reconnected, and, you know, he was touring the world. And then there was a period of 2 years that he worked on 24 Karat Magic. Oh, and by the way, when we were working on Showman, he was working on this one song for 9 months that was driving him crazy. And that was Uptown Funk.
Oh my God.
Wow. Wow.
So we were reconnected. So then fast forward to 2.5 years ago, we get a call from Julia Michaels, who was the music supervisor for Showman at the time. And she was on Showman, I believe, for 3 years. So she had our songs on her hard drive. And David Talbert came to her, because she's the music supervisor on Django. He came to her and he said, I need a songwriting team. And she said, oh, well, I have these songs these guys did for Showman. And he heard them and was like, I love it. Let's meet him.
Wow.
That's how we got the gig.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. That is such, I mean, from a Vegas, like, hey, one, you know, oh my gosh, that's amazing. So then when you go to that meeting with her and with David, had you written more demos? Did you, you sat down and you're like, hey, do you want to, you know, was it more about like sort of a chemistry meeting as opposed to like, here's all, you know, here's what we see for the project, or how did that go?
We didn't know anything about the project. David Talbert had the idea in his head for 20 years.
Wow.
So the first meeting was myself, Philip, and David at Phil's house. And we just clicked, the three of us. It was just synergy. We just like, I don't know how, we just clicked. And we did Phil and I have our little thing that we do where we, you know, after in every meeting we go to the piano and I just start playing and Phil starts singing and we improvise a song and the Dong and Pony Show. And, so we did that and Talbert was just so into it and he's like, all right, well go write a song. I don't think that there was a script even at that point. So we wrote a song and that was, you know, the first song that we wrote and we actually had Shoshana Bean demo it.
No.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome.
So a little backstory. The reason that Davey is here is because Shoshana Bean texted me and said, hey, I have some friend who's written some movie. Do you want to have him on your podcast? And I was like, I mean, I'll do anything for Shoshana. I was like, yeah, of course. And then she sends me who it is. And I was like, Wait, the movie's Jingle Jangle. Are you kidding me, Shoshana? Like, just playing it cool, like she always does, always plays it cool. How do you guys know each other?
So I met Shoshana in 2004. I was playing for Brian McKnight, and she was, you know, I don't know if she was signed to Brian or if she was about to be, I'm not sure, but she was around the camp. And that's how we met. And I believe that she was, she came from New York. We met in LA. She came from New York with David Cook, her piano player, who's still her piano player. And yeah, we just, I don't really remember that period that well, but we met 5 years later in LA and we were out somewhere and we're like, you know, I remember you, and we became inseparable since. I've played so many shows with her. We've traveled the world together. We've been to Hawaii so many times together playing shows, like just me and her. And
that's amazing.
I've done her shows at the Standard so many times.
Yeah, yeah.
During COVID, we've done shows here at my house.
Oh, wow.
And I stopped playing professionally in 2014, so 6 years ago. But Shoshana is the only person I still play with.
Wow.
That's amazing.
She's sneaky. That's awesome.
Yeah.
She's so sneaky. And we
back
owe her
to we owe her a sandwich at least.
Yeah.
great. A t-shirt.
I think she has one. Back to the back to Jingle Jangle. To us, you know, it seems like it is a good old fashioned linear book musical, a la, you know, the great Disney movie musicals that we've covered on this show a lot and that we love and grew up on.
Right.
What's your history with musicals? Have you studied the form? Are you a fan at all? You know, how did you go about this process of writing something kind of outside of your comfort zone?
Yeah. So, I'm not a musical theater kid.
Sure.
I grew up, going to a lot of musicals. My mom would take, me and my brothers to musicals when we were young. And I always liked them and I liked the songs, and then I would watch a lot of movies. I grew up on Mary Poppins and, you know, those kinds of films.
Same.
But I was never, like, in high school, I was not in, you know, I was into jazz.
Right. Again, a lot cooler than Joe and I were.
Very cool. Just everything opposite of us. So,
I mean, but you know, when I meet these like musical theater kids, especially like the piano players, the musical directors and arrangers, they just know it so well. And the Sondheims and this and that. And I just don't, like, I didn't grow up with it. I don't know that world that well. But I would go to the theater, especially when I lived in Vegas. I saw a lot of shows. Whenever I was in New York, I would go to see shows, but I was never in that world.
Yeah.
And same with Phil. I believe he's had the same upbringing. Like, he would see shows every once in a while. I think actually he may have been like in shows, like when he was 18, I think he was in, Lion King in like Florida or something.
Amazing. Oh, wow.
He was maybe a little more involved than I was, but you know, I come from jazz. He comes from like pop, R&B, gospel, that world. But we always liked it. You know, we always liked musical theater and the songs and, you know, telling a story through song and all that. So working on Jangle was a huge learning experience for me. I like to research. I'm a big researcher. So if I dive into something, like I just dive into it.
Yeah.
Like even when I first started playing with Tony Braxton, like a month or two before I got the gig, like I just got all of her albums and listened to everything. And then once I was on the road with her, I got all the Babyface albums and all the Anita Baker albums, because that's who she listened to.
Right.
So I just had to dive all the way in. So when we started working on Jangle, I got into musical theater through the songwriters and I got into like more like film musicals. So
Totally.
The Sherman Brothers were my first, the first thing I dove into, and I watched everything and, you know, learned everything I could about them. And I'm a huge fan. They're incredible. And then, Menken, you know?
Yeah.
You can't make a movie musical without, you know, acknowledging what he's done. And also he scored those movies too, which is incredible.
Yeah.
Like what? So, I just watched everything I could and just watched like how, you know, how he writes the song for the bad guy, the I Want song,
right.
The inspirational. So all of that. And it was more about just watching as much as I could. And then when we sat down to write a song, usually we would have like 20 minutes to write a song. So, it would all just kind of pour out, you know.
What 20 minutes? What do you mean? Like there were deadlines, like you guys were in a moment and they're like, hey, we need a musical moment right here. Like run in the other room. You know, like John and Paul trying to like write a song as quickly as possible or something.
Yeah. So I go back to the story. Like, we met Talbert that one night and he said, write me a song. We wrote one song, Shoshana Bean demoed it. And that was the song that got the movie greenlit.
Wow.
Netflix heard the song, loved it. Was like, yes. It's kind of the big song in the movie. Can't wait for people to hear it. Madeline Mills, who's the actress, she's like 10 years old. Mm-hmm. Her song, it's called Square Root of Possible. And so that, you know, we started that journey. So for about 8 months, I had Phil and Talbert here in my studio every day. And we were writing songs. We wrote over 30 songs and ended up with 8.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like a musical. I mean, that's, you know, that's the story. That's the sort of, this is a bad one, but that's the tale as old as time. Like, you know, writing just, what we did, we talked about the Music Man on here, a couple of weeks ago and Meredith Wilson wrote like, Dan, what was it? Like 80 some odd songs or something.
Like 75 songs. And the same thing was true for Alan Menken's Aladdin, which he wrote with Howard Ashman. And they basically had a full version of the musical that was 40 songs. And then only 8 of those exist. And then there's other songs that they didn't write. So it's, just good thing you're good at improvising and moving quickly.
right. But the way that we would hand in songs, like they would be fully produced. Not piano vocals. I mean, I would do it all at home, but you know, some of the songs are huge and I would arrange for strings and horns and band and choirs and, you know, cause the, you know, David Talbert wanted to hear it the way it was going to be.
Right.
So for 8 months we were writing and messing with these songs and tweaking them. And, you know, it could be like, he would say, you know, after the second chorus, give me 32 bars of score music. I'm going to have the camera pan down and go and do all this stuff, like film score. And I would do it. It would take a day to do it. He'd call me the next day. Oh, man, I love it. It's great. 3 days later, I don't know. Take it out.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
We wrote the first song. The second song we wrote was the opening number, which, as you know, is a huge number.
Yeah, always.
Yeah, and it's a duet, and there's it ends up with a choir and all the characters and everyone singing together, and it's a huge, huge number. It took us a long time to get it right. I would say at least 50 revisions. And
wow.
Yeah, of lyric, melody, form, whatever. So fast forward a year later, we're at Air Studios in London. We're 3 weeks before we start shooting. And at this point, you know, it's a huge production. I was used from touring and, you know, touring with Christina Aguilera or like New Kids on the Block. It's like, there's 100 people on staff, 10 semi trailers. Like it's a huge production, but a movie is a completely different game. Right. So you have like, all these buildings with people like designing the costumes and the shots and the sets and, it's a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So, and all based on our songs, which was a trip because it was like songs that we just wrote here. Now, like all these people are working on them. So we're in the studio and we're doing the pre-record. So the cast is coming in and we're recording them on the songs. And David Talbert comes in one day and he's like, you know, the opening number, I don't think it's right.
Oh.
And I said, well, you know, once we get like the real like drums and orchestra, because it was all MIDI, like I was all demoing it. I said, you know, it would be great. And he's like, no, I think we need a new song.
Oh my God.
To like scrap the melody, lyric, track, everything. New song. We're 3 weeks from shoot.
Oh my God.
So, you know, I took Phil outside. We took a breath and we went back in. And we, you know, we just started writing a new song. And in 3 days, we had a new song. And that's the opening number in the movie. And now it's released. Usher did a cover of it.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
So when I say, yeah, like we had, you know, a lot of times like, all right, go, like write a song now. The I Want song, which is the second song, we literally wrote in 15 minutes. And we wrote in 15 minutes and then we drove over to Dave's office and performed it for him. Like, wow. This should be in the movie.
Oh my God.
It was a lot of that, you know.
I love those stories. Like, we live for those stories. Like, that is just the coolest right. behind the scenes stuff.
It's cool to talk about it now, but
in the moment, right?
Yeah,
right. And like, you also, and this is probably, this is nothing. I mean, you've done so much, but I wonder that like people who have written, you know, musicals after musicals. I mean, I wonder if this happens in the pop world too, but that like you almost know to a certain degree that like a song's going to come. You're like, okay, so if we get in that position then we need to write something, we will write something. But like you guys had never really written a musical before. Right. And it's like, no, not only does the opening number need to hit, but it also needs to accomplish XYZ and all of these things and introduce character and problem and all of the, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So I imagine that was pretty, pretty freaky.
Yeah, it was. And especially like you live with a song for a year, 100 revisions, like you know, you can't imagine another song there or like the
moment, right.
But we had to.
It's know? So cool. It's
yeah,
so cool.
We had to. And also with this movie, there was a thin line, like we talked about it a lot. Like this is a black movie, basically, you know, a black. Yeah. So, and we haven't had a black musical since The Wiz, really.
Right. Yeah.
So where does it live musically? You know, we didn't want it to be like The Wiz is very R&B and soul. Mm-hmm. We didn't want it to be too much like that. Mm-hmm. And then Showman is very pop.
Yeah.
So we didn't want it to be all the way in that corner also.
Yeah.
So there was a thin line of like, it's got to live in all those worlds. And then there's like Disney movies, which we all love, like the Mankin kind of thing. Like we wanted to live in that world too.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was a thin line, you know?
Yeah.
Hopefully we did a good job. We'll see.
I'm sure you did.
Thanks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You just touched on a second ago and we were wondering about this just because, I mean, it's an all black Christmas movie. I mean, it is a black cast. It's a black story. I wonder how much of that, I know John Legend's production company was involved and, you know, it feels unfortunate that has to be remarkable in this day and age, but it is, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that and just like.
Mm-hmm. That, and also this is the first black film. This is the first time, that we're seeing black people fly.
Wow.
Like in this way, I mean, there was like a Will Smith movie, right? But like to see like black kids flying.
Yeah,
right. In that kind of like, magical way, the Peter Pan like fantasy way.
Yeah.
Kind of,
yeah.
Yeah. And that was important for David Talbert. You know, he has a 7-year-old son and he just wanted black people to be represented in this way and to have this like inspirational characters.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really cool, man. Really cool. I mean,
that's amazing.
A lot of times I'm like, I'm just a kid from Israel. What the hell am I doing here? You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Physical.
I did see, this is just sort of another like musical theater nerd question. I saw on a picture on your website of Tom Kitt. He involved in some way as far, I mean, he's like musical theater, you know, royalty, that guy.
Yeah. He was involved for a little bit. We brought him as like the voice of musical theater, you know.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, and I forget when that was, way before shoot. I think don't remember. Maybe it was like a table read or something.
Yeah.
That he was involved. And I know that I was insecure about the songs. I'm like, is this good enough for Broadway, for musical theater? And he was like, yeah, it's great. Don't worry about it.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Cause he's the king of that. He's written all sorts of different kinds of styles. He's often brought on to make something make sense. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got things that hit like a rock shows, and then he's got things like SpongeBob that just live in like this amorphous place.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's super interesting. I'm curious how, so, you know, you improvise kind of the beginnings of songs, and then you produce these high level demos with MIDI tracks, meaning like electrical, you know, mechanical, computer tracks, essentially like computer orchestra tracks, and you bring those in, and then at what, then you record them live with a big orchestra. Like get the whole Netflix budget and do that thing.
Exactly.
How long was it until that process took shape? Like was that happening? Actually, really the I'm getting to the question. Don't worry. It'll come eventually. Were you watching the film while you guys were making those orchestration choices and composing, or did that happen pre-production of the actual film?
Right. I learned that, you know, this is my first movie.
Sure.
Never made a movie before. I never made a musical before. So I learned that,
trial by fire, like just jumping in the deep end, like Netflix, just everybody, like, you know, it's amazing.
So movies have like three main parts, like periods. There's the pre-production. There's like the production, which is shoot and everything that, you know, rehearsals and shoot. And then the post-production. For our movie, I think the first part was about 8 months. Second part was about 8 months. And then the next part was about a year. So when we get to shoot and we have these demos, these fully flushed out demos, like, yeah, they have like what the orchestra is going to play, what the drummer is going to play, and they shoot to that. And then when we were in post, there was an orchestrator and a film composer also at that point, and they took my MIDI stuff and just kind of translated it to an orchestra. And we did all of that, by the way, during COVID. So we recorded the orchestra in London at Air Studio on Zoom. So there was a period of about 2 months, I want to say April and May of this year, where I had to wake up every day at 6 o'clock in the morning and watch an orchestra play on these songs. And also the way we did that was they had to break up the orchestra. So strings were one day, and then brass was one day, and then woodwinds another day, and the percussion another day. It done. Yeah. And then they did the songs for, I don't know, maybe 5 weeks. And then they did the score for another, I don't know, month and a half or something.
Oh man. Well, that seems like you missed almost the best part. Like you didn't get to be there for the record. I mean, cause we see these videos, like I made one cast album for a new musical, which was an amazing experience, but you see these videos of like, you know, the entire Beauty and the Beast orchestra.
Right.
And there's Jerry Orbach and Angela Lansbury and Alan Menken's like sitting in the back with Howard Ashman, like smoking a cigarette, talking about like, what the fuck are we going to do?
Yeah.
You know, like, so you guys had to do that. That sucks. But, you know, I'm sure, you know,
I have some videos on my phone of me taking a video of the computer, you know, with the Zoom.
God, what a time.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's so crazy. What I had a question too, because you have worked on some TV projects as well. And so like, I mean, this is a very kind of lame question, but I do wonder about the difference between, you know, working on a pop, you know, working with a pop person, artist, you know, working on a record and then going to work for TV, or something that has that sort of, you know, the narrative behind it.
Right.
That process is like for you.
Yeah. So I worked for a year. I worked with Rodney Jerkins, who's a super producer. I attribute a lot of my growth as a songwriter and producer to working with him. He made like, when he was like 21, he was working with Michael Jackson. He made his last album, Invincible.
Wow.
And he's had a million hits with Beyonce and Mariah and a lot of people. And so I worked with him for a year. I'd go up to his house every day and just working with him, watching him. And then for the last few months I was there, we worked with Lee Daniels on Empire and Star, two TV shows that have a lot of songs in them.
Yeah.
And so I saw how he works with a director and how to write for a character and, you know, what works on TV versus pop music, like radio, right. Writing with a story, you know, all of that. So to answer your question, I'm not sure, like, cause that, those are like pop songs. I've also done scoring, like I've scored a few things and that's right. Just like, you have to capture the emotion that's on the screen.
Did you do any scoring for Jingle Jangle, or was that separate?
No, that was John Debney, who's okay. A genius. He did Elf and Showman and Passion of the Christ.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Because watching the trailer, there's like this moment that I wanted to talk about, because in the trailer, first of all, there's like some crazy electric guitar and a beat right as Madeline Mills is like discovering the toy and stuff. And so I'm like, okay, this is a new Christmas movie with that, you know, with music from our time, but also like, does Carol of the Bells have to be the only song that is used when something is foreboding? It's right. Like, oh no, something is wrong. Right. And now cue a remix of Carol of the Bells, whether it's this or whether it's Home Alone,
right.
Like, that's always been it. So I was like, right. I was like, who had right. their finger on that button?
Mm. I don't know. I saw the trailer with everybody else. That, you know,
it's so cool.
I didn't see it before. I've right. watched the movie a zillion times at this point.
Right.
I think
right.
when we came back from shoot yeah. in London, the first version of the movie was 3.5 hours long.
Oh wow! Of course.
And now,
so is most musicals. Most musicals are like way, way too long.
Right. Right.
They start.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a song that was cut out actually from the film. That was a tough one. Just put a lot of work into it and it's just cut out. But I think it's going to be on the soundtrack.
Okay, good. Yeah. That was my next question.
Yeah. It's going to be on the soundtrack, and Nika Noni Rose sings it. Yeah. So those things happen. You can't, you know, they say your songs are your babies or whatever. Sometimes you have to give them away or kill them or whatever.
Oh, no, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
It's so hard. Uh-huh. What would you say has been, you know, you've talked about a lot of the challenges and cutting songs is definitely a challenge. What's your biggest challenge as a songwriter? Or is there a time when you can remember that, you know, you had to get over some insane hurdle? You've obviously had so much success in your career, but was there a time you can remember that was particularly hard on you?
Mm. Well, I would say, and first of all, I'd say I'm not where I want to be or where I'm going to. So sure. I'm still facing hurdles every day. I think the hardest part with songwriting and production is that often, and the higher levels you go, there are so many cooks in the kitchen and there's so many people that have to like what you do. Mm. And that's just tough. Everyone has an opinion. You know, the managers and the lawyers and the hairstylist and everybody.
right.
And so it's hard to kind of nail it and to get to like, all right, this is it, you know? Because when I send something and it leaves my studio, like I feel good about it. But then it takes people, you know, 10 seconds to know if they like it or not.
Yeah,
so that's tough. And especially, you know, on the higher levels, when you're dealing with A&Rs or music supervisors, like these people listen to 500 songs a day. So something that I slaved over for a week and tweaked and did, you know, thought about every little part, you know, they listen to for 30 seconds. And they're like, nah, thanks. Next.
Oh God.
Yeah. So that's tough. That's still kind of tough.
That's brutal.
You kind of have to have thick skin about it. And you have to keep making stuff and like having that level of detail and, you know, and I think in today's world, like you have to know how to do everything. And, you know, everybody knows that now, but like me, like I wanted to be a songwriter and producer, but I have to be a mixing engineer and a recording engineer, and I have to know how to tune vocals. And like, during COVID, I've really gotten better at mixing, which is something I never thought I would do. I always thought, you know, I always like sent it out to somebody else to mix. Mm-hmm. But now, right. like, it, you know, it's like I don't have time to do that, or I just need to have things sound awesome, you know, leaving my room. So
right.
you have to know all these things, you know. It's a lot. And you have to keep up with the times and the sounds, and, you know, it's, yeah, like one sound can ruin your song if it sounds like 2 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So yeah. How do you stay with the trends? How do you know what's everything is supposed to sound like now? Right. How do you get ahead that way?
Right. Well, I listen a lot. Usually Thursday nights are my listening time. Cause music comes out on Friday. Mm-hmm. So Friday at midnight or whatever. So I usually listen to like 4 or 5 new albums, every Thursday night. So I listen a lot. And, then I'm up on like the software and sounds and all
the gear. Yeah.
Gear stuff, what people are doing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned, I mean, this is one of our existential questions, but you mentioned like where you want to be. Where is that for you? What do you see when you think about that?
Well, I've always loved hit songs, since I was a kid. I just love hit songs. If you ask me like what music I would take to a deserted island, I would take the top 10 Billboard songs from the 50s to today. Like, I just love hit songs. So my goal has always been to contribute at least one song to the American karaoke book, you know?
Nice.
That's a goal.
That's cool.
And working with somebody like Philip, who's contributed like 20 of them.
right.
It's awesome. And just watching how he does it and how him and Bruno have done it, is, you know, you can't pay for that kind of education.
Right. That's so cool. And like you say, you just hit the nail on the head. You want to be around people who make you better and, you know, people who like push you in a way that you want to be pushed. And, you know, that, I mean, that's perfect. So, I mean, you couldn't be closer to, you know, you couldn't be closer to that goal, you know, in a way.
Right. No. So maybe you'll get one here. Maybe one of these songs will just be the song that all young kids want to sing.
I hope so. And another goal is I really enjoyed working on a project like this long term. Like working on something for that long. I like working with a lot of people, you know, a lot of creatives. So more projects, another movie musical, be awesome.
Great. Sounds good to us.
Yeah. I don't know what's in the future for Phil and I, but we are so good with each other. We've known each other since 2005. And we know each other's, just how we write and our pitfalls and like what, you know, it's just great to know a friend and a writer so well, and you build together. And, you know, it's obviously like him and Bruno have done that so well.
Right.
So I'm just honored to be around him and to keep doing it.
I love it. And I got one more. Can I ask one more like sort of tacky question? Cause just from a musician perspective, like when you come up with an idea and you want to send it over to Phil or send it to a collaborator, or you want to show them. I mean, I can imagine there's like that scene in the movie in our minds where like, it's just, you walk over to the piano and you're like, hey, just check this out. I got this idea.
Yeah.
Is that really what it's like?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it.
Usually like writing.
What a nerd.
Yeah. Writing for this movie. You know, when you're writing for a movie musical, you get the script and there's no songs in the script.
Of course.
And a lot of times sometimes he'll put like, okay, a song should be here. But a lot of times, you know, it's not there. So we have to come up with it. And so we look at the script and we're like, we think a song should happen here, or this character should have a song. And so we write it and we present it. And usually the way it happens is like Phil is here. We're like, okay, let's write for this character. And then I just start playing something. Yeah. So I have to come up with something like, which is like the musical DNA of it and the vibe of it and the chords and, you know, whatever it's going to be. So I do something. And then he starts improvising and we have the tape going on. We record it. And then usually there's something there, you know, we listen back and we're like, oh, that's a good line. Oh, let's use this. And then we start writing. That's usually how it happens. Sometimes, and Phil and I have gotten really good at this. Phil will be in the car and he'll just sing a melody. And he sends me that melody and I put it in my, you know, in Logic, and I start writing to that. I put it in, you know, with a click and time, and I start writing to it. You know, I put chords and drums and everything. So we'll do that too. But a lot of times it's just me like improvising a groove or like chord progression or, you know, vibe, and then we'll go off from that.
So that's exactly what I wanted to know. That is the exact answer that I wanted. Thank you very much.
It's always hard because you're always like, is he going to like it? Is this good? There's always that. Or even when I send him something, or even the director, like I can send him an MP3 and I'm just looking at the phone to see if they replied, you know, like for hours.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
If they didn't reply after 6 hours, what, they hate it? Or, you know, yeah. Still going through that.
Unbelievable.
Listening back, being like, is this the worst thing I've ever done? Am I done? Am I finished?
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Always. Uh-huh. Do you have any advice for people who might want to get into songwriting, or something you wish you'd known back in the day before we let you go?
Okay, so here it is. So with songwriting, there are a lot of like parameters, I call it. Like there's like how well you write melodies and how well you write lyrics, how well you write choruses, how well you write opening lines, how well you write chord changes, how well you write bridges, right? And that's just songwriting. Then there's production. How well you program drums and pick your sounds and orchestrate and all of that. So you're not going to get good at all of those things at once, obviously. You're going to get good at like a few things with each song by like very little, if that makes sense. Right. So,
yeah.
It just takes years for you to build all those skills, because those are so many skills there. There's just so many skills. And then, you know, there's the recording aspect of it. How do you record vocals? How do you arrange background vocals? How do you tune vocals? Vocal production, ad-libs, all that stuff. It takes years getting good at this stuff. And I think every song teaches you something. You know, some songwriters say finish every song that you start. I don't think so, because there's definitely, I mean, I'm probably up to 2,000 songs written by this point. I definitely didn't finish a lot of them. There's definitely songs that I took them as far as I could and I abandoned them. I would say my recommendation is take it as far as you can, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And as far as you can in that moment is the best you can do for that song in that moment. And if you don't have anything else to give the song, just move on, start a new one.
It's so sick. Yeah, that's great. No, it is. It's like, and it's for all, it feels, you know, equitable for all art in general, you know, for writing and acting.
Right.
It's like, you know, different roles, things, the stuff that we do. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's so complex. I mean, even just like playing piano, there's so many things that you can be good at, that you need to be good at. It just takes years, man. It just takes time.
Yeah.
And you can't take time. Yeah. So.
No, that's fantastic. That's amazing. Dan, you got anything else? I mean, I could sit and just nerd out about, you know, the specific specs on the keyboards behind you for the next hour, but that won't be helpful for anybody.
Right.
We'll lose listeners by the second, but.
I'll just say there's nothing newer than, like the newest keyboard here is from 85.
Wow.
I'm a nerd for like really old stuff. This is my latest purchase, is ARP 2600, 1971.
Unbelievable.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
That's so cool. That's so cool. This is so great, David. Thank you for
thank you so much for
talking to us. This was great, and thank you to Shoshana.
Yes.
Thank you to our listeners. Jingle Jangle, written, directed by David E. Talbert, starring Forest Whitaker, Felicia Rashad, and Keegan-Michael Key, comes to Netflix today.
Mm-hmm.
Holiday season is here. Let's do it. Thank you
so much, you guys. This was awesome.
Thank you for listening to Guys Who Like Musicals. We are produced by Dan Tracy and Joe Carroll, your hosts. You can find us on Instagram at Guys Who Like Musicals or on Twitter at Musical Guys. For more information about us or our show, please visit our new website at guyswholikemusicals.com. You can find our merch store, our Patreon page, and more. Thanks for listening.
Have you ever wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor, and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.